Hi, my name is Aaron Margosis. I'm here to talk about legacy web app security. I work in Microsoft Consulting Services. I'm based in the DC area. I work primarily with US federal government customers, but I've done work with a lot of other customers around the world as well. And there's one thing I see, or the few things that I see over and over and over again with regard to legacy web apps that actually cause you harm as you bring them forward. And I'm going to talk about three things that I've seen repeatedly that I think there's probably not enough awareness around, and hopefully this will help people. So hopefully after this session, you'll be able to identify some risky practices that you may not have realized were problematic before, and to be able to persuade people to make the changes that are necessary to make your environment more secure, and to articulate some various options that are available. I'm going to talk about some that you can do yourselves, and I've also brought people from Browsium to talk about alternatives for a couple of the problems that I'm going to raise, because they have solutions that can help mitigate some of these issues. Okay, any phone I hear becomes my property. That's the rule. So this comes up a lot during, I've seen this come up a lot during Windows and Internet Explorer upgrades. People start upgrading and then apps stop working because when they do the upgrade, they're sticking with the system defaults, and those defaults are different from what they had done to their systems before. And that calls attention to the problems. Now, naturally, what they want to do is go back to doing things the insecure way so that the apps will continue working. Other times, this comes up just when there's a security review, and people look at things and say, you know, this is not good security practice. We need to move this forward. I got to plug the book. Mark Rusinovich and I co-authored the Windows SysInternals Administrator's Reference, which is like a 500-page compendium of all the SysInternals tools that are available, and the most comprehensive documentation available anywhere about how to use the SysInternals tools like Process Explorer, Process Monitor, Auto Runs, and there's actually 70 tools that are covered in the book. And it's on sale at the bookstore. There's a discount. I think it's like 20% discount here at the store at TechEd. And Mark and I are signing the book Wednesday and Thursday. The Wednesday one you'll need a time machine to get to. That was earlier today, but we'll be back there tomorrow from 11 to noon, 11:30 to noon. Mark will also be signing other books he's been coming out with lately. He came out with a novel called Zero Day, which I recommend. And then there's also the Windows Internals book, the sixth edition. So some people confuse the Windows Internals series and the SysInternals book. People say, oh, yeah, I've got your book, Aaron. I've had multiple editions of it so far. I said, no, different book. The Windows Internals series, which is co-authored by Mark Rusinovich and David Solomon, and now with Alex Ionescu, is all about the internals of the Windows operating system. If you want to know everything about memory management and the security subsystem and things like that, this is the book you want to get. The sixth edition is now out, and part one of the sixth edition is now out, and it covers Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2. It's only part one because the book is continuing to grow and grow with every single edition, and it was just getting so large. One, they were never going to get it out if they didn't break it up into parts, and two, it's getting so big they can't fit it into the binding anymore. So part one is available in the bookstore, and Mark will be signing those. How many of you, by the way, were at my talk yesterday? Okay, just a few of you. Okay. So I can use the same jokes again. So three things I'm going to talk about. One, very high risk, insisting on keeping old versions of Java around. Second risk is wittingly or unwittingly keeping old IE settings and moving them forward from your IE5 or IE6 system and continuing to bring them forward. People don't always realize they're doing it, but it can cause some problems. And then I'm going to bring up what I consider a very insidious risk. I don't know that this risk has been exploited, but it's really easy to exploit, and there's a lot of environments where they are allowing ActiveX controls that are not marked safe for scripting to be used in web apps. And that can actually be lead to very serious problems. So first, let's talk about Java. Sun Java, also known as Oracle Java now. It's a question of application compatibility. The problem, the application compatibility problem is this. You write some code, you deploy the code, it works perfectly fine. Okay, and then something about the system changes. You install security fixes, you migrate to a new operating system, you apply a service pack, and now all of a sudden the app's not working anymore. In the Microsoft world, we regularly had a problem that was called DLL hell, right? The makers of Java had what they felt was a really good solution, and it was this. You write your code for a specific version of Java, specific build, and it works perfectly fine. Okay? Now you're guaranteed that your app can always have that version of Java available. And so you can install the next version side by side, right? Down to the build. Like you can have multiple builds of 1.2 or 1.4 side by side. And you can have your app can specify, I need, you know, 1.4 build 12, right? And then be guaranteed that even if newer versions of Java are installed, your app will continue to use the version of Java that it was designed and tested with. Right? That sounds like a pretty good idea. Oops, gave away the next line. So at the time, it was a good idea. You know, mid-90s, you know, security was, you know, the security threats we faced then are very, very different from what we've got now. Now, though, not only can your app specify, I need this particular version of Java, but so can malware. Okay, so when you are installing these versions side by side, the old versions often have security vulnerabilities that are not being patched. And so malware can continue to exploit these things even if you have a newer version installed, just by specifying, I need this particular version. So many Java runtime engine updates contain critical patch updates. They usually contain, you know, a dozen or more per update. You cannot keep older versions around and continue to be protected against the threats that are being introduced by the older versions. And you may have older unsupported versions that, you know, there's no documentation that this is vulnerable to a particular hack. But, you know, new hacks that are being discovered today may still apply to older versions of Java from a long time ago. And if you have them installed, you're just open to all kinds of threats there. The Java support lifecycle is very, very short. 1.5 went out of support, out of public support in October 2009. And 1.6 is ending later this year. You know, 7 just came out, and 1.6 is going to, they're going to stop releasing patches publicly just in a few months. They've already announced, you know, Java 7 just came out last July, and by 2014, they will not issue patches for it anymore. Not publicly. You can pay Oracle to get patches, but a lot of people don't do that. How big a problem is this? Well, it has become, in the last couple years, the most widely attacked component on the Windows platform. In early 2010, Symantec reported a notable rise in Java vulnerabilities through 2009. And then the Security Intelligence Report, which relies on telemetry from lots of systems throughout the world, the Microsoft Security Intelligence Report, started seeing actual exploits succeeding on Windows systems due to Java. And there was this huge spike in the middle of 2010. The latest security intelligence reports continue to see this very high level to the point where Java is the most widely attacked component on the Windows platform. And there's, you know, lots of toolkits out there that make it very easy to build malware that attacks specific versions of Java. The latest SIR shows this rise in HTML slash JavaScript. And I asked them about it, and this is not actually vulnerabilities in HTML or JavaScript, it's the delivery mechanism. So that delivery mechanism can still exploit Flash or PDF or Java or, you know, Word and Excel vulnerabilities, but they were identifying the delivery mechanism there. Java still remains very highly and very widely attacked. And the problem is because lots of people don't update their stuff. So a lot of the vulnerabilities we're seeing, I was going to put a graphic in here showing that a lot of the attacks that are succeeding are against stuff that has been patched for years on Java. But because people insist we need this particular version, they remain vulnerable for a long period of time. So a customer asked me last summer, you know, we've tested our apps on 1.6 update 17. What do you think of the idea of our just using that and leaving it there? This slide is already out of date as of yesterday. Leaving Java unpatched like this is like saying we have built our Windows 7 image in, you know, February 2010, and we're not going to install any patches. It's the same type of thing, right? The malware authors out there, they're not attacking Windows because it sucks. They're attacking Windows because it's popular. They attack Java because it's very widely available. It's there to be attacked. So they're attacking it because it's vulnerable and widespread. So if you standardize on update 17, for example, it's actually yesterday they released another critical patch update with another 14 vulnerabilities. So you're allowing 142 different pathways into your machines if you have Java installed at this level. By the way, if you don't have update 24 or higher, you're not going to be able to go to Internet Explorer 9 because the earlier versions are not compatible with Internet Explorer 9. So it's a risk question. How much risk are you willing to take on? Are you willing to open up your systems to several years of very well-known vulnerabilities? Ah, here's the graphic I was thinking of. So the attack we're seeing the most was patched in 2010. And I believe it was patched by one of those first updates in the list. Oracle, by the way, agrees. And Oracle no longer supports the side-by-side installation. Somewhere during the 1.6 line, if you install the newer versions of 1.6, it overwrites the earlier versions of 1.6. You can have 1.5 and 1.6 side-by-side, but you can't have update 17 and update 32 side-by-side. So it'll overwrite the previous versions. They highly recommend that you remove older, unsupported versions of Java from your systems. And they will tell you that it presents a very serious security risk. So they're now moving away from the write once, you know, keep that version of Java around forever. That promise no longer holds. They also say, and I'm not a Java developer, but Oracle says that the latest version is always compatible with older versions. So there should be no reason to insist on update 17. The way to get around this, don't demand a specific version in your code. Just use what's on the system. Okay. There are some low-level libraries that were introduced many years ago, that have very tight dependencies on the system. Those, from what the Java developers have told me, are really not needed anymore. The functionality that's available in the Java libraries now is rich enough that you shouldn't need to use those low-level libraries. One thing we can do in Windows when we have an app, there's lots of apps out there that insist I need, you know, Windows XP Service Pack 1, is we have these app compat shims that we can apply to an application and lie to the application, and you can be running on Windows 7 Service Pack 1 when your app asks what version of Windows am I on, we can say this is XP Service Pack 1 and then allow the app to continue to believe it's on XP when in fact it's actually on 7. I don't know of anything that we can do like that for Java. There's no version lies available. the browsing guys will show another approach to isolating these things, but it's not the same as a version life. Ideally, when you apply Java updates, it should be just as uneventful as applying Windows patches. How many of you do full regression testing of all your applications before you release patches into your environment? One. You have, you, not all of them? You, full regression testing or just basic, like make sure this stuff works? Yeah, so smoke testing basically. Yeah, you can do smoke testing, that makes sense. But a lot of people insisted, you know, unless we retest everything, every bit of functionality, we can't be certain that installing this Java update isn't going to break everything. And it's generally not true. You should be able to install, you know, if you're writing code moderately intelligently, it should continue to work. Any questions about that, about Java? I was hoping to show a demo and set up a system getting attacked by Java, by you know malicious Java, but it wouldn't have worked out very well. So no questions? Let's move on. Carrying old Internet Explorer settings forward. There seems to always be this desire to make Internet Explorer work just like it used to. And there's some things we've seen customers doing, I and colleagues of mine, to standardize on what we had and bring it forward to the present. One is copying Internet Explorer settings from older versions of Windows and Internet Explorer, either using reg files or using Internet Explorer maintenance. Another is the mistaken belief that turning off protected mode will help their apps work, or turning off user account control, and also turning off data execution prevention. I'll talk a little bit about what that means here. So, lots of customers I've seen, lots of customers. They get a bunch of IE settings, they export it out to a reg file, and then in their image build, you know, when they're building their standard image, one of the script items invokes regedit to pull in these settings. And you get this excellent self-documenting file that sets up the system just the way you want it. Now, of course, you know, everybody knows 1406 is access this computer from, or access this page from another domain or whatever it's called. Everybody knows, you know that. The XIE guy doesn't know that. But you do know what the zero means, right? That's enable or disable. It is allow. Okay, I didn't remember that. So the thing is that they suck in all these things, and then they have no idea what they actually do or why they're there, because this is not exactly a good record of why we're applying a setting. And regedit is not exactly the pinnacle of configuration management, right? So the thing is that they don't know why they're applying these things, and they end up with this Frankenstein system that has a mix of settings from a variety of places. No one remembers where they came from. And that can lead to lots of security problems. There could be lots of things in here that you don't want to have set. So what I do whenever I'm working with a customer that's building a new Windows 7 image is every single thing they want to put in there, every single setting change, I request, because I'm not allowed to demand, I'm just a consultant, I request, what is this setting for? Can you tell me what it's for? If not, take it out. Only put in stuff that you have a known good reason and still have a good reason for putting them in. Another one is Internet Explorer maintenance. How many of you have used Internet Explorer maintenance in your group policy? How many of you do group policy stuff? Okay, and you don't use Internet Explorer maintenance? Okay. This is Internet Explorer maintenance. Internet Explorer maintenance is from the very early days of enterprise management for Windows and Internet Explorer. It predates real group policy. You know, with group policy settings, you can apply policies, and then if you remove the policies, it rolls back to what the defaults were, because the policies go into a different place in the registry than the original settings. Internet Explorer maintenance didn't work that way. And what you would do is if you brought up the security zones and content ratings tab. Come on, click. And bring this up, and you select Import the Current Security Zones and Privacy Settings, even if you don't modify anything. What it would do is suck in all the settings into a big file and then deploy that out to everything in your domain. It's getting that from the system on which you're capturing the information. So it's a lot more than just we've got specific settings we want to apply. It's pulling in everything. So what happens when you do this and then you apply the same settings to a newer version of Windows? Oh, by the way, Internet Explorer maintenance is finally gone, starting in Windows 8. Question? Auto detect. Okay. There are some settings. I'm going to ask Matt Crowley to answer this one, if you can remember. There are some settings in the IEAK and IE maintenance that are... I don't believe WinINET settings are not captured by maintenance? Here. This is not going to end well. Yeah, if you can stand up with the microphone. The settings that are, they're moving more stuff into group policy in Windows 8 to cover some of that, but go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah.
Who asked the question? Oh, I don't think, so those are WinINET settings and not Internet Explorer settings. So the Internet Explorer maintenance will pull your URL actions and feature control key settings, but it won't pull your proxy auto detect configuration settings. So you'll have to do that through group policy after you migrate.
You currently set it in the same location, but it's not using the same mechanism.
You need a microphone, Matt. Here. The connection settings.
Right.
So that component always has to be there.
Correct. And so what we're saying is that the IEM settings, there's so much legacy stuff, and then they put it in. It's not applying the proxy auto detect pieces in the same way that you're importing those configuration settings. So some is going away, some is moving to a new area, but it's not really different. So it'll get very confusing.
IEAK is still there. Okay. But this thing that would suck all the settings, all the URL actions, the permissions for the different zones, for example, and then apply them. When it applies these, it is overwriting the default, so there's no rollback. There's no way to get back to the settings that were originally on the system. And so here's some of the changes going from IE6 to IE8. This is a utility I wrote called IE Zone Analyzer. The URL for it is down there, and it allows you to view and compare settings across a bunch of different security zones and across computers as well. You can save the settings and compare them against settings from a different system. And here you can see that, in particular, the trusted site zone got locked down a whole lot starting in IE7. We didn't really announce it very well, but trusted sites is now more restrictive than the intranet zone. The intranet zone is now the most permissive zone. And what we also didn't bother to tell everybody is the idea now is use intranet for everything inside your domain, particularly for things like single sign-on. And the trusted sites is for external sites that need a little bit of additional capability, like protected mode turned off. But even in the internet zone, there were lockdowns there that you're losing if you take your IE5 or IE6 settings and just whack them over top of your IE9 and IE10 settings, or IE8 in this case. So using group policy instead of IE maintenance, you can specify, I want these particular settings modified and only these. I want these defaults enforced. I want to open up this specific item because there's a specific reason I need that particular one opened up without just blindly capturing a ton of settings from the year 2000 and applying them to a modern system. Another thing a colleague of mine, Eric Lawrence, has seen customers do is to turn off protected mode to fix applications. So protected mode is a feature that was introduced in Windows Vista and IE7 and carried forward in IE7 carried forward in Windows 7, Windows 8, etc. And what it does is it severely restricts the ability of the process running in protected mode, the web page running in protected mode, from modifying the system. It restricts where you can write files and registry keys. And it's turned on for the internet and restricted site zone. It's disabled in the intranet and trusted site zones. And you can turn it on or off with the different security zones. You can actually go into I'll screw up this system. All right, so you can go in here and turn it on and off. This is the security dialog. The security dialog is for messing up your settings or to allow end users to mess up their settings. So it can be enabled or disabled on a per zone basis. We recommend leaving the defaults. Strongly recommend leaving the defaults, and especially in the internet zone. Protected mode has saved people from lots of trouble already. It prevents lots of drive-by attacks from doing anything dangerous on your system. Another thing is if you turn off user account control, that turns off protected mode globally for all use of Internet Explorer. So we strongly recommend not turning off UAC on client systems, in part for that reason. The thing is that lots of line of business applications are written for Java or ActiveX that expects to have certain access to the file system or the registry. And so those should generally be run either in the intranet zone or trusted sites. And so a lot of times customers don't know how to do that, and they see it's not working, and something that's on their intranet is actually resolving to the internet zone. The apps are breaking, and they say, what happens if you turn off UAC? Well, it works. Or turn off protected mode? Well, it works. Okay, so do not turn off protected mode in the internet zone, and do not turn off UAC. Just make sure everything in your intranet zone is mapped correctly to the intranet zone. Now, if you have sites that have dots in the names, right? Even if it's your own company, mysharepoint.myorganization.com, right? If there's dots in the URL, by default, Internet Explorer is going to say that's in the intranet zone. You need to go into either the security tab or preferably through group policy in the site to zone assignment list and say, star.myorganization.com, intranet zone. And then all that stuff will start working. Protected mode will be turned off, but you'll still have protected mode for the intranet zone. Data execution prevention. Data execution prevention is a feature that causes apps to crash. That's what it does. That's a good thing, right? Causes apps to crash. Good. Why? The idea with data execution prevention is, memory on a system, it's all really the same. And you can have a piece of memory that sometimes contains executable code and sometimes contains data. And in the past, before we had DEP turned on, NX stands for no execute, which is another name for data execution prevention. Before then, what attackers would do is push data into memory, maybe through a very long query string in a URL, or form data, or something like that, overly long, longer than the web app was expecting. And along with that, they would include binary data. So now they're pushing into memory more data than the program was expecting, and it can cause, through a buffer overrun, cause that program to foul up and then start executing data that the attacker submitted. Right? So the data they're submitting is now being treated as executable code. The instruction pointer of the CPU is now pointing to that data space and trying to execute it. And so you've all heard of buffer overruns, right? And how much harm they can cause. So one of the things that we did by turning on DEP was to say, memory that is supposed to be data should never be executed. And so now we can turn that on and say, you know, data execution prevention is on. If the instruction pointer ever tries to execute something that is not marked for execution, then crash the program right away. Let me show you what that looks like. Bring up. Here is a sysinternals tool called VMMap. And I'm going to look at the virtual memory of explorer.exe. And here you can see there's stuff mapped as image, mapped file, heap, stack, and so forth. If I look at image data, so image is stuff that's brought in from executable code, right? EXEs and DLLs and things like that. And you can see here that it's all marked, the protection on it is either read, which means you cannot write to this stuff, or execute and read, meaning you can execute this code or read from that piece of memory, but you can't write to it. And if we expand some of these, I think we might see some. Here's some read-write. So there is a data section in this executable, but it's not write and executable. If it's writable and executable, the bad guys are going to find it. The places where we see DEP failing is because certain components that get written and get put out there mark memory for both writing and execution. And that's a recipe for disaster. You look at the heap, and this is all read-write, but not execute. So you can modify this stuff, but you can't point the instruction pointer to it and start executing it. Likewise, with the stack, read-write and guard. So a guard page is one that if you try to access it, it triggers an exception and it increases the size of the stack. So you can, you know, reserve this much memory, but then only allocate this much memory, right? Or commit this much memory. And when you hit the end of that, it grabs a little bit more of the reserve memory, a little bit more. So that's what the guard page is for. But there's nothing in here that is writable and executable. Okay? But with DEP turned off, this wouldn't matter. This protection goes away. Right? Now you become vulnerable again to attackers being able to push stuff in through oversight, you know, through buffer overflows and things like that, and heap spray and other techniques that they have, and cause code of their choosing to run on your computer. So with data execution prevention, yeah, it doesn't make the vulnerability go away, right? You still have the bug in the code. They can cause your program to crash, but it's a whole lot better for your program to crash than to start executing code that doesn't belong there. DEP crashes come from three different sources. One is from malicious code. Okay, there's an attempt to execute malicious code. So this is exactly what DEP is designed to protect against. There's also non-malicious code. So, you know, there's just-in-time compilers. Java would turn the bytecode, the Java bytecode, into executable code, machine code, and start executing it. So old versions of these components would do this and JIT stuff on the fly, create some executable code, and then start executing it. And back before the days of data execution prevention, they didn't need to modify the protection. So some of these old components can cause DEP crashes. And so you want to make sure, that's another reason to keep Java up to date, because newer versions of Java are DEP aware, and if they generate executable code, they'll mark the memory as executable before they start executing it. ATL, ActiveX template libraries from Visual C++, also would generate this. And some of the old ATL components would cause these problems. So Internet Explorer specifically looks for those and introduces some shims to take care of that in the background to keep those particular things from crashing. And then the third type of crash is just, you know, the instruction pointer gets pointed off to some random place, some random data area. It's not intended to be executable. It's just something went seriously wrong with the program. It's probably going to crash anyway. So this crashes it a little bit sooner. So again, keep DEP turned on to protect yourself against these techniques. Again, Browseum will talk about a way to solve the DEP problem in a different way. In Internet Explorer, we almost always see depth crashes coming from add-ons of some type. So turn off add-ons and see if that turns up anything. We had one customer, one of my customers had this problem. They wanted to turn DEP off. And so we got a process dump of the crashed process and started looking at it. And it contained MS Java, Microsoft Java, which hasn't been updated since, 2004? Way out of support, should not be installed anywhere. Customer didn't even know they had it installed. And I don't know if it was directly responsible for the crash, but it certainly doesn't help. So it may well have been part of the problem. Any questions about carrying old IE settings forward and making IE act always the way it had in the past? Okay, the next thing I'm going to talk about are the use of unsafe ActiveX controls in web applications. I see this come up a lot. So ActiveX has a bad rap. Everyone thinks ActiveX is inherently unsafe. And that's not exactly true. So let's talk about what ActiveX actually is. It's a software reuse technology, right? It's pluggable components that you can reuse in different ways and have interact in ways that weren't predicted by the developer. So Olay automation, for example, you can have a Word document that has an Excel spreadsheet embedded in it. Now, Excel and Word don't have direct knowledge of each other, but when you click on that Excel spreadsheet embedded in the document, now Excel code is loaded into the process and it starts working. And that's COM and Olay, object linking and embedding, causing that to happen. Another thing is it gives you scriptable interfaces. So you can do a whole lot of stuff with a VB script file. How many of you do management stuff where you run a .vbs file? Anybody? A few of you? I used to do it all the time before PowerShell. And even with PowerShell, launching these components, these COM components, these ActiveX components to do useful things is still something I rely on all the time. It also became Internet Explorer's plug-in model. So all browsers have some kind of plug-in model. Why? Because in the mid-1990s, HTML, you could only do so much with HTML, right? It was very, very limited. And so plugins like Java and ActiveX were developed to increase the capability of web apps, right? So you incorporate a Java app that can do a whole lot of stuff that you couldn't do in HTML. You incorporate an ActiveX control that could do a whole bunch of stuff and create a native Windows interface, often written in VB. So Java has a sandbox and has had this since the beginning. So the idea was you can have your Java app be allowed only to perform certain operations. ActiveX never had that. ActiveX is always native code, and it could do anything that the process containing it was allowed to do. So if you have ActiveX controls that allow you to run arbitrary code, that becomes a security risk. And that's where I think some of the problems with ActiveX, or the perceived problems with ActiveX, occurred. And so Microsoft made a distinction between ActiveX controls that are safe for scripting and those that are not. So there's lots of useful purposes for ActiveX controls that are not safe for scripting. Inside, when I say safe for scripting, I mean inside of a web page delivered by some server out of control of the local machine. There's lots of scripting you can do with ActiveX that is really, really useful, but you don't want to give that power to web pages. So safe for scripting is an assertion made by the ActiveX component that says no matter what data is passed to me, no matter what method is called, it won't cause harm to the end user. And the definition of harm is spelled out in some documentation on the web. And by default, Internet Explorer will look for this assertion. The assertion can be set by having some registry keys associated with the component, or it could be the iObject Safety interface implemented by the binary component when it loads. It can be queried, are you safe for scripting and initialization? And if it says yes, that can be loaded into a web page. Security setting that you can tweak, though. And by default, no pages on networked machines have the setting enabled to allow ActiveX that's not safe for scripting to be loaded inside a web page. But that's a setting you can change, and I've seen lots of customers do it. Initialize and script, ActiveX control is not marked safe for scripting. It's a per zone setting, and it's disabled today in the intranet, trusted sites, internet, and restricted sites. The local computer, I think, set to prompt, I'm not sure. All the security guidance out there mandates or recommends that this setting be disabled, but they do so only for the internet zone. They don't say anything about intranet or trusted sites. Oops. Sorry, what?
I said they need to.
They need to.
Until you get that mandate, we're authorized to decrease the settings in the other zones to get stuff to work.
Right. Actually, I was at a big meeting with the Department of Defense and the Microsoft security people, and I pushed for getting this changed for the intranet and trusted site zones, and I was not successful this time. It may go into the Microsoft security guidelines, but the DoD is not going to mandate it at this time for their computers, because it will cause, as I'll show you, it will cause some trouble. So what isn't safe for scripting? Some examples of what's not safe for scripting. Microsoft Word. Microsoft Word has a very, very rich interface for scripting. Have any of you ever written macros? I would expect more than that, but okay. So you can write VBA macros in Word and Excel, and you can actually have external scripts. VBS files can do the same thing. But Word allows you, its interface is so rich that you can actually use it to launch arbitrary programs. Other things, the Windows script host is great when you're doing management of a system, but it's not so good if you're inside of a web page delivered by a remote web server. And the file system object and the other scripting components are other examples of things that are not safe for scripting because you can do anything that the end user is allowed to do once you allow that. And the thing is, you cannot enable just one of these things without enabling all of them. Okay, you can't just enable Microsoft Word without also enabling the file system object and Windows script host. You also cannot enable it for one site in a zone without enabling it for all sites. So if you have it enabled in your intranet zone because of one app on one server, you know, you're enabling it throughout everything on your intranet. And also for trusted sites if you enable it there. Again, Browsium's going to talk about a way of mitigating that. So why would anybody ever relax this setting? Again, limitations of straight HTML until recently. So people would turn this on so they could write their line of business stuff and deliver functionality through web apps. And in particular, the creation of Word and Excel documents. Do any of you have apps in your environment where you generate Word documents or Excel documents on the fly with custom content in them? And how do you do that? This way, exactly, right? So the thing is, there hasn't been, until very recently, a server-side capability for generating Office documents, until very recently, starting in Office 2007. Also, another reason people are willing to relax the setting is because we didn't always prohibit it. Trusted sites used to be completely wide open until IE 7. And so the setting for the trusted site zone was set to prompt. So if you tried to script Microsoft Word from within a web page in your trusted site zone, the end user would get this dialogue, right? And ActiveX control on this page might be unsafe to interact with other parts of the page. Do you want to allow this interaction? Now, what do you suppose a security-conscious end user would do when faced with this? They'd look at it, they would not understand what it is. I mean, what other parts of the page? The menu? The company logo? What does this mean? Now, of course, that never even happens, right? Because there's no such thing as a security-conscious end user, right? It's a mythical beast. Do any of you know any security-conscious end users? No hands are going up. Exactly what I'd expect. Yeah. End users who see this dialogue say, Windows sucks. It's prompting me again. I've learned that if I click yes, stuff works. So the text may as well say, do you want this dialogue to go away? Yes, please. So after people get bugged by this dialogue for a while, the system administrators say, you know, screw it. Just set it to enable. Just enable the use of unsafe ActiveX controls because we're going to use them anyway. So prompt is pretty much the same as enable or yes. So what can happen here? What kinds of things might happen in an environment like this? Say you have a less than morally upstanding person who is a web developer, and he's responsible for a tiny piece of the company homepage, the internal company homepage. Okay, he's not an admin of anything. He's not a help desk admin. He's not a domain admin. He has no access to anybody else's computer. All he has is he can control a little bit of what goes into, say, the news feed on the homepage. What can he do? If unsafe ActiveX is disabled, there's not a whole lot he can do that's malicious. I mean, he could put malicious news in there and say, you know, beer in Bernie's cube at 3 o'clock, but if unsafe ActiveX is enabled, he can just change a few lines of some obscure file and start dropping files onto other people's computers and modifying the run key. He can do anything now. He's got full access to a user's session. So Matt logs on, he browses to the company homepage, and all of a sudden, his computer, without his knowledge, has now been configured so that every time he logs on, some stuff is going to run that he doesn't know about, and it's going to be maybe emailing stuff to some Gmail account. It might be keylogging him, a whole bunch of stuff. And then the guy, a few days later, changes it back to its original settings. Now, everybody's machine is infected with his custom stuff. Good luck figuring out how everybody got infected. That's an awful lot of power for someone who shouldn't have any. So when I bring this up, people say, well, look, we've had this setting enabled for years, and we've never had any problems. Really? How would you know? And how do you know that even if you haven't had any problems, how do you know that next week you'll still be able to say the same thing? Because this attack is so easy to pull off. And as you see more insider attacks and targeted attacks and advanced persistent threats and things like that, this is just the kind of thing that lots of companies that have something worth having should start paying more attention to. So how do you fix this? It's going to depend on the specific app. Why is the app relying on unsafe ActiveX? I had one customer who, this was really bizarre, I thought. They had this page, and they had this text box, and they wanted to pre-populate the text box with the domain / username of the logged on user. So they were using this scripting object, the WScript network object, to get the username. And I suggested, well, you know, we could fix that. Why not just use Windows Authentication? Captured on the server, and then push it into the page, make it part of the default stuff on the page. Turns out they weren't using IIS for this particular application. I suggest, okay, how about make the user type it the first time, then save that, what they type in, into a cookie, and bring that back every time they come back to the page. And they just flat out refuse. No, it must behave exactly this way. Fine. So here, you might want to develop a custom ActiveX. I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail shortly. The most common example, though, is the office automation problem. The solution here is create the content using Office Open XML. So starting in Office 2007, we ditched the old binary proprietary file formats and came up with something that's standardized. There's, you know, standards for it, and it's XML, so you can use standard XML interfaces and code to manipulate this stuff. Turns out, though, that Office Open XML is very, very low level. And the SDKs we ship don't give you a lot of functionality. It's like writing big applications in assembler. I have some colleagues back in DC who are doing some work for a customer where they're moving all this document generation to the server, and they've been at it for a long time. Hopefully what they're going to do is take that stuff that they've developed and publish it for others to use. There are actually examples of libraries that you can use to automate Office Open XML. It doesn't require Office being installed, it's just XML. But a lot of these libraries, you go to codeproject.com, for example, there's a bunch of examples of libraries you can use, and they're all open source. The problem is some of those licenses for the open source licenses may be problematic for your organization. For example, there's a bunch of them that looked really useful that are under the GNU license. As Microsoft employees, we pretty much have a blanket policy that we can't use that because it puts our intellectual property at risk. So we can't use it in our projects. So they're writing stuff from scratch. Another way to do it here is to write a custom ActiveX. Now, that sounds like a really bizarre idea. The idea here, though, is what you're doing is you're taking the functionality that you need in that web page and encapsulating it into your own custom ActiveX that just does that function and nothing else. So it can't be abused to run arbitrary code on the system. You're providing a minimal external interfaces. So unlike Word, which offers a ton of interfaces that even allow you to run arbitrary executable code, this would be just using the minimal set that you need to just build a document, for example. You can use further lockdowns with your custom ActiveX. You can lock it so that it only works on one particular site or to a particular security zone. One of the good things about this model is if you go to using Office Open XML, you're really changing the architecture of your app. You're moving lots of code. You're writing a lot of new code server-side. With this, the architecture of your app is still basically the same. You're still doing all the work on the client. You're still depending on Word and Excel and things like that. You're just encapsulating your existing code in a different way. So this could be a very valuable short-term bridge. Here it is graphically. So here's where you're allowing unsafe ActiveX. And you're doing some useful stuff in this app, but you're also, because you're allowing this, you're allowing some other page to basically run arbitrary code, as symbolized by the command prompt there. By not allowing the use of ActiveX and writing a custom component, the green component here, that component, once you write it, can do anything it wants, but you're only going to write it to specifically do the things you need it to do. Okay? So it's not possible for the web page to access that unsafe material and invoke executable code that you don't want to allow. So how do you build an ActiveX control today? Not with .NET. .NET doesn't build COM components, it builds .NET components. The only way you can do it today using Microsoft technology that is fully supported is to use Visual C++. It's the only tool we ship that you can build ActiveX with today. The ActiveX template library helps, but this still requires a bit of an investment. You need to find people who, one, are familiar with C++, which is a dwindling force, I believe. Two, they need to know how to use ATL. And three, they need to know how to use the Office APIs from the COM interfaces using C++. What's that? Question? An ActiveX with C#? Oh, with the interop. I need to modify my deck, clearly. I want to talk to you after this. Yeah. I was not aware. Yeah, I guess you can build an interop. Yeah. It was not available 3 or 4 years ago. Man, you know how many people at Microsoft I've shown this to, and nobody ever mentioned that? Wow, okay. That might be better than using VB6. Because that's what I was going to recommend. the most productive tool we ever built for building ActiveX controls, discounting the C-sharp example, is to use VB6. VB6, you could write a lot of code very quickly. I mean, it had a lot of limitations. But for a lot of basic functionality, in particular around automating Office, because if you ever look at the macro environment, if you press Alt F11 inside an Office app and it brings up the VBA editor, the Visual Basic for Applications editor, it's all VB. It's using the exact same interfaces. So that's really the easiest way to automate Office. A lot more people still know VB6 than know C++. Now the question is this a supported mechanism? The Visual Basic 6 Integrated Development Environment, the IDE, is long out of support. It came out in 1998. It's been out of support for years. It does not run well on Windows 7. But VB code that you write can still run in a supported way because the VB6 runtime is still part of Windows. Okay? It's still part of Windows XP, obviously, Windows 7, Windows Vista, and Windows 8 also has the VB6 runtime. So you can depend on that being available. And if there's any security vulnerabilities in the VB6 stuff that ships with versions of Windows that are still supported, they get patched. So VB6 is not entirely an unsupported way to go. Quick, yes? So I'm going to repeat this in case anybody, I don't know if anybody listens online, but there's a recording of the session. The comment is, you were told by Microsoft that after 2010, code written in the VB6 IDE was not supported, even though the runtime is there. I've never heard anyone say that before. Let's chat about that afterwards. I could be wrong, but I'm usually not wrong, except when I'm wrong in a very public way regarding the use of C# to write ActiveX. So anyway, I do have a demo here that I think might be a little fun. One thing I can say is that running VB6 on Windows 7 is not necessarily going to work very well. But it always worked in the past on XP, and you can continue to use it on XP, right? It's just that, if you have problems with VB6 itself, that's out of support. You need a custom support agreement to get Microsoft to help you at all. So I'm on 4. I'm on 3. Here we go. So here's XP. Here's another good reason to have XP mode even, which I generally don't like. So let's go to this web page. I have a little web server running on here. I have this in my intranet zone, and I have changed my settings for the intranet zone. I have this site added on my local network here, and I have changed the setting so the initialize and script ActiveX controls not marked as safe for scripting is set to enable. Okay, and I do that because I need to generate an Office document. Okay, so that's Word being automated from within the web page, right? Take a look at that source code. Typical kind of stuff, right? I set some values, and these may come from form fields on the page, or it may come from the server. It may be pushed in from the server. And then I have a method that's tied to that button where I create a shell application. I load this template file. I launch Word using create object word.application. And then I start automating it. I add the template file to an existing or to a new document and then start populating form fields. Okay. The problem with this is I can do anything from here. What can I do? I can run arbitrary code. So this makes me vulnerable to, this is a big noisy thing. My attacker who's modifying my web page content, he's going to do something a lot more subtle. So here's an example. See, you can run create object WScript shell, run, do anything he wants. What I want to get to is this kind of code here, where I'm going to create a custom component. I'm going to invoke a custom component and have a method on it, new equity facts doc. Pass in the values I need. That's all it can do. Okay, and I can mark that safe for scripting. So, oh wait, let me get that source back because I'm going to need that. Let me come in here and copy this code. And let's go to VB6. And I've created the skeleton, right, of this COM component, this ActiveX control. And here's the method. I've created this entry point to this ActiveX control. And I'm going to paste in that code because the similarities between VBScript and Visual Basic for Applications and VB6 are so huge that in many cases I can just take VBScript, save, build, done. Let me see if that works. Let's go over to this Win7 system. And let's launch Internet Explorer and take a look here, verify that here, the same site is going to be in my intranet zone. Initializing script, ActiveX control is not marked as safe for scripting, is set to disable. Let me go ahead and register that control. So I have a little PowerShell script and the DLL and then this thing to mark it safe for scripting. All this thing does is it searches for the prog ID I enter in, finds the class ID associated with it, and creates a couple registry entries under that class ID. I'll publish this on my blog at some point. But let me run that. Okay, DLL register server succeeded, and it's created those two components. So now I have this control that's safe for scripting. So I'm going to go to this web page, and let me verify that these other methods don't work anymore. So let me bring up the developer tools, and go to the console, and I'll try creating it launching Word directly. Permission denied. So that breaks. If I try to launch the command prompt, ActiveX component can't create object. So those malicious methods, or potentially malicious methods, are no longer available to the website author. But this custom ActiveX can do the work I need it to do. So I can still get my work done exactly the way I did before for a fairly low effort. Any questions about that? So the reason for doing this is it seems kind of like a short-term bridge, but the thing is, if I tell you there's this security problem and it's going to cost you a whole bunch of money because we have to write a whole bunch of new code to fix it, and what you'll end up with is a web page that gives you exactly what you've already got today, a lot of businesses are not going to be willing to make that investment. They're going to take the risk instead and say, just keep the insecure settings instead and we'll hope nothing bad happens. This makes it something that's, you know, fairly quick, very low cost, gives you better security and doesn't break your business. There was a question there. Can you use the microphone since you're so close?
In our case, we needed to create Excel documents on the server. And 2 years ago, we had Excel installed on the server. And this was a web application. And when we consulted with Microsoft, they said that, no, this is not the way to go. You have to have the client create the document and then upload it to server, and that's the only good way to do that.
That's right. Yeah.
In this case, you created the document again on client.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what is the option for creating those documents on the server without using that OpenXML, which, you know, doesn't really give you a complete capability. In our case, for example, if you want to create an Excel document with protection for password, it won't, you know, there was no easy way to do that.
Right. That's just been one of the limitations since forever. Word and Excel and things like that have always required that they be run within an interactive session. You may be able to trick it somehow in some circumstances to run on a server or in a non-interactive service, but a lot of times that'll break. It's not a supported scenario for any of the Office client applications to run them in an unattended fashion like that, in a non-interactive fashion like that. What they told you was correct. Those particular programs need to be run in an interactive client. You can script it, but it needs to be on an interactive desktop. And IIS can't give you that on the server, and services running as local system, for example, can't give you that. So yeah, your only alternative to do server-side generation is Office OpenXML. It's just one of the inherent limitations that goes way back to the beginning of the products. Okay, at this point, I'd like to bring up the Matts, Matt Heller and Matt Crowley, if he's coming up, to come and talk about Browsium Ion and how it offers another way to solve some of these same problems. Let me give you your machine here.
That's real quick. There we go. So I will just give a quick introduction. So thank you, Aaron, for that. We're going to talk about how we can help solve these problems. Not a product pitch, and it's really not about that. But the issues that Aaron brought up are the scenarios that we envision our product helping to solve. And so a little bit about myself and Matt as well. I spent about 7 years working with Microsoft as a product expert on the IE side. Matt was with the IE engineering team for 3 years. You can blame him for everything ActiveX related that you don't like. That was his area of expertise. Matt has actually written the book on Internet Explorer development as well. So we as a company exist to solve browser-related problems. When Aaron was talking about earlier of the high risk, the medium risk, all of those scenarios exist today, as Aaron points out, and the only solutions that Microsoft are providing are very broad brush strokes for that. So you can solve a lot of the problems, but there's collateral damage. So we're looking at the problems of how do we solve the immediate needs around compatibility, interoperability, and solving the issues like Aaron just mentioned of a business isn't going to invest a lot of time and money into a solution that gets them exactly where they are today. And so Matt's going to walk you through a specific scenario that we've built around being able to run two versions of Java side by side for a business need, but without having to expose the older version of Java to the public, because we've only got just a few minutes here. So,
just a quick demo here. When Aaron was talking about side-by-side Java, one of the problems is that a website, if you have multiple versions, can arbitrarily instantiate an instance of Java via its GUID when you go to a web page. So if you have 1.4 installed alongside with 1.6, a website can instantiate Java 1.4 just by specifying the GUID associated with that ActiveX control. What we allow you to do using IE is instantiate a specific version of Java for a specific site and isolate it for one web page, maybe a domain, whatever granularity level you like, while using the latest version for the rest of the browser. So we have a web page here, and what this does is it uses a control that was meant for Java 1.4, and the problem is that some of the Java APIs have changed between Java 1.4 and Java 1.6. So this is an example where you have Java 1.6 installed on a machine, but you have a specific enterprise application that requires a specific version of Java that it was written for.
So the idea here is he's going to make it so that you can only invoke 1.4 from a particular site or a particular page. You wouldn't be allowed to invoke it from any place else.
Correct. So on your systems, what you could do is you could killbit all the other versions of Java so that by default you can have side-by-side Java installations, but only the latest version can run in a applet tag, and no other version can be instantiated via an object tag by specifying the GUID. And then in a manager application that we have here, I'm copying the URL from the web page. I'm opening up our manager. What we allow you to do is essentially create profiles for a web application, and you can specify different IE features for a specific web page, different files and registry settings for one specific web page, and those will only be enacted on that specific page. So here what I'm doing is I'm swapping in the ActiveX control from Java 1.4 whenever the Java 1.6 ActiveX control is called. Once I set this setting, I can create what we call rules, so you can specify those contexts in which a application can use Java 1.4, for instance. And then you can save it and test it out on your machine. So what I'm saying here is we have a website called Agrid, and I'm creating a rule that says anytime the URL includes Agrid, or I could paste the whole URL in there just in case you want it to be very specific about the sites that can use this. Anytime that a web page tries to use Java 1.4, if it says Agrid in it, allow it to run Java 1.4, otherwise run Java 1.6. So I'm in the manager, I'm going to save this locally. So I'm going to save it to my current user here.
Fully supports group policy and all the other pieces, so this isn't just that scenario, but Yes, I'll speak into your chest. It fully supports group policy. It supports full integration with a Windows AD. The idea here is just to sort of quickly show you what we want to accomplish with running an older version of Java, very, very isolated and very structured. You're also going to see it flip over in a second. Aaron had mentioned MSJVM earlier. This version of Java doesn't support Arrow, so we get Windows 7 Basic. We do have customers that want to run MSJVM. They have been legally allowed to do it. You can do a lot of these scenarios, but it's all about granularity, and it needs to be secure, whether it's Java in this case, or we have Flash, we have companies with Adobe Reader, turning DEP on. It's all about granularity, so you ensure the security of your applications, and you're managing the exclusions, which is really what Aaron's been talking about this whole time, of how do you do that, and how do you effectively make it happen.
Yep, so essentially you can have multiple tabs using multiple versions of either Java. You can turn off DEP, for instance, on a web page only for one specific site. And we also allow you to here, if you're testing a specific Java version, switch dynamically into different profiles that offer these different settings. So I can switch between Java 1.4 and Java 1.6 in a single tab, just by flipping on a button. So you can, as Aaron talked about, you don't have to turn off a setting for a whole zone. Our solution, or using other solutions like ThinApp to virtualize an instance of IE.
Supported, by the way.
Not supported by Microsoft. Allow you to set one specific setting for one specific instance without affecting all of your zone settings for Internet Explorer.
To recap.
Okay. All right, thanks, guys. Just want to review. Hopefully, you learned something here that you can take back, be at least aware of some of the risks that are out there that you may not have been aware of before, and persuade others of the importance of getting them addressed. Some references. I've blogged about the Java issue. Eric Lawrence has written up a really good write-up about explaining DEP and NX. The initializing script ActiveX controls, identifying the problem, I've blogged about. I haven't yet published the documentation showing here's some ways you can fix it. That's coming up. And then the security intelligence report that I referenced a couple times is linked here as well. So thank you very much for coming. come up and talk to me afterwards if there's any questions you have. Thanks a lot.